I'm Tracy, I'm an alcoholic. I am bringing my cell phone just so I don't talk to y'all till tomorrow. My sponsor always gets this look on her face when I say I've been asked to speak for a speaker meeting because she's like, oh, good, somebody gave you an hour to talk about your sales. And it's your favorite. I'm really glad to be here. It is truly an honor and a privilege today to be asked to do anything for Alcoholics Anonymous. That is a statement that I had no expectation of saying when I was new. When I was new, it was not an honor to be here. It was shameful. It was not a privilege to be here. It was a kind of sentencing condition. You know, not quite yet, but we were looking that way. So I figured I'd just get the jump on it before the judge had a chance to impose it. Be a good girl. My sobriety date is August 7th of 2011. It is not my first sobriety date, but I hope, God willing, it's the last one that I'll ever meet. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor, and I believe my grand sponsor. Yeah, she's got a sponsor. Everybody, as far as I can, that I know and have any interaction with, we have sponsors. I have women that I have the privilege of sponsoring for as long and as much as they, you know, have a willingness to let me. I see a couple of them are going to get gold stars because they signed on to Zoom. I am very, very grateful, to be sober today and have the opportunity to have all of those things in my life. If you are like I was when I was new, I had the attention span of a fruit fly. And so the most important things you need to know is that, I go to as many meetings as I can get to. You know, with time and kids and stuff, that isn't what it used to be. It's not 7 days a week anymore, but I go to as many as I possibly can and I make a solid commitment to do that. I try to have service positions at those meetings. Every day I get up and ask the God of my understanding to take the wheel because Lord knows I have messed it up enough with my own driving. And I talk to my sponsor regularly and I try to implement the steps into a spiritual way of life as outlined in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Those things, are the reason that you don't have a different speaker tonight. Those are actions that I take. It's not how I feel. It's not what I want to do. It's not whether or not I'm having a good day or a bad day. The steps and the work of Alcoholics Anonymous is like hygiene for me. All right. I might make it a day or two without a shower, but after a little bit, everybody pays for it and everybody notices. So I try to treat Alcoholics Anonymous the same way. And if that's all you get, because you start zoning out and thinking about your taxes, that's the most important thing that you need to know tonight. Because that's really what did it. I have tried every other way. And I'll get to that in my story. So I'm a big believer in clarifying that what I'm going to talk to you about tonight is what I was like, what happened, and what I am like today. A lot of times I hear people at the podium talk about it, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. Well, my experience is it didn't change. I changed. It was always the same. My family was the same family. My work was the same kind of expectation that you actually show up and you don't steal time and you're not drinking on lunch hour. You know, like everything else around me, the world around me operated exactly as it was supposed to. And it has continued to do so without my orchestration. You know, so it's about me. I had to do this work to change, right? I was the one that was ruining my life and the lives of people around me and definitely causing grief for the commonwealth. I grew up in a household where both of my parents loved me. There is no question in my mind that my parents loved me absolutely to the best of their ability, and they did the best that they could with me. That said, when it comes to dysfunction and sickness in my family, I'm kind of a worker among workers. Everybody's got something a little different. I happen to be the only alcoholic in my immediate family. My extended family has a lot of drugs and alcohol in it. But in my immediate family, my mother and my father both are those people that, I'll tell you one story about my mother and I'll tell you all you need to know. We went to, I think, P.F. Chang's once when I was living in DC, and she was like, oh, they got a plum mojito. That just sounds nice. So she got herself a plum mojito, drank maybe three drinks of it, and goes, oh, I'm starting to feel it, honey, come take this. And I'm going, quitter, you push past that. You know, like, what? There's not an alcoholic bone in either one of my parents' bodies. Okay, it just isn't there. Nothing happens to them like what happens to me, right? I don't think I even ever saw my parents drink until I was probably 16 or 17. I think my dad had a finger of scotch at my wedding, and it was mostly because of the cost of my wedding to my starter husband, I think. But yes, there is definitely one of those. So, there was a lot of chaos in my household growing up, right? And when I first got here, there was a lot of different chaos. There was a lot of abuse. Okay. There was a lot of different emotional abuse, verbal abuse, sexual abuse, you name it. There was a lot of it growing up from different members of my family. And if you have that experience and you feel like you can't get sober because of it, or if it explains why you drink the way you drink, come sit by me. Because for a long time, I thought you couldn't help me. Because if you had lived through what I had lived through, if you had gone through what I had gone through, then you would drink like I drink. And the unfortunate fact is, being an Alcoholics Anonymous for a while and going through the steps, I had a sponsor lovingly explain to me that my sister had had the same childhood and she was not, in fact, drinking herself to death, which really blew my goal to graduate from here and leave and go on back to life. I found out that it had nothing to do with my childhood. Because as I've been here for a long time, I've seen a lot of people who had perfectly idyllic childhoods. I don't know where these people come from. Okay, if that's your story, if that's your childhood, it was just like sunshine and roses and everybody was happy, I promise you, you will hear people like that from the podium. It just ain't me. But I've got a couple of friends like that where they were just these black sheeps of their family. And I'm like, I don't know where you sign up for those families, but they got lucky. They had that experience, but they were still just as alcoholic as I was. And so I learned pretty quickly that wasn't going to be the answer, right? And so I learned pretty quickly that because of the grown-ups in my life, things being difficult and things being not what I had hoped, not the expectation that I had for my childhood or what it should be, right? Which I don't know where you get those ideas, but they're there. At least for me, they're just there. It's like a spider that knows its web upon birth. I knew what everybody should have been treating me like, from like as long as I can remember. And so my sister, her path was, she was just hell on wheels. I mean, she was just, if you had voted which one of us was most likely to be an alcoholic, it would have been my sister, hands down. I mean, hands up, she was wild. And I was a nerd. I didn't talk much. I did good grades because I decided that under the radar was the best way to get out of trouble and stay out of trouble. Because if you got good grades, they didn't come pounding on your door asking you what you were doing. You got left alone. And honestly, I think 85% of my life has been me in one way or another trying to manipulate just being left alone. Right. I really think that's what my brain thinks is going to be the most successful part of my life is when I'm finally just left alone. But my sister kind of did what she did, and that gave me a wonderful scapegoat, because she was the bad sister and I was the good sister. And so I just went out of my way to get good grades. My parents, I kind of became this mediator in their marital spats while they were still together, where like I would sit them down at the table and no, now you talk, now you talk. Like, everybody thought I was very level-headed. I was an old soul, which I just kind of was like, no, keep it coming, keep it coming. I loved it. I loved hearing that you liked me because I didn't like me. I did not like me. I do not have anything negative to say about alcohol, personally. I don't have a thing bad to say about it because I truly believe that it's what kept me from killing myself until I found new people. Because how I felt about myself from as early as I can remember was that I don't belong here. I'm not good enough to be here. I'm not like you. I remember in kindergarten, all the other kids were, just being kids, right? They were just running around, raising heck on their first day. And I remember I was sitting on a table watching them going, I don't know what to do with my hands. What do you do with your hands? I was like five or six, and I still felt awkward, right? And I had that feeling as long as I can remember. When I was in high school, I didn't drink all the way up through to high school as a late bloomer for AA. And I did not drink anything in middle school, got to high school, and it was in high school, I didn't talk much, but if I did, I was just a witch. And that made it easier that you didn't like me because I was nasty, as opposed to you just didn't like me for who I was, right? So I would sit in, you know, my classes, and, you know, I was in AP classes mostly because, like I said, I wanted to go to college. I wanted to get the hell out of that house. And so I would sit there with a newspaper or a book, and I wouldn't say a word until somebody said something I took umbrage with. And then I would pick up and I'd just be like, you are a moron, and let me explain to you why. Needless to say, I didn't have a lot of friends. You know, I didn't understand, you know, I felt like I was right. But you know, most of my friends were teachers, and mostly I think they just kind of took pity on me. So I graduate high school and I move on to this college with 30, 40,000 kids. And I was 17 years old. Okay. I didn't know crap about crap. Okay. My family kept me very sheltered. My parents were very strict. Even at my senior prom, my curfew was, I believe, 10 o'clock. And we lived 45 minutes from prom. So it wasn't, I didn't get an opportunity to have those interactions with other kids. And I remember once I went to a party my senior year, it was May of my senior year. Okay. This was my first drinking experience, other than, like, you know, a sip for my dad being like, you know, beer tastes terrible. You know, it was a normal 7, 8 year old. So I go to this party and I had heard about it, and everybody was like, oh, BYOB. And I was like, who is Biob? Like, what the hell is that? You know, like, I had no idea. I had no understanding of drinking or drinking culture. Right. And so I go to this party. Clearly I did not bring my own because I didn't know what that meant. But I do remember everybody looking at me like I was an alien, because the witch showed up, you know, like, it just, it was like, you know, dee, 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 you know, like, nobody understood why I was there. You know, nobody liked me. I didn't like any of you. I, you know, was what the impression I gave you. So people just kind of cocked their heads like that little RCA dog, you know, and just were like, and one of them just kind of handed me a beer. Like, I don't think they knew what to do. And I didn't get drunk. I didn't have anything go on that night. But what I learned before I went to college a few months later was, this is what kids do to fit in. This is what you do. You drink. So I filed that away because I was going to reinvent myself in college. Okay. I was going to be a new person. There wasn't going to be any more. I was alone and lonely. No. I was going to make this work because I was finally out of that house. And by God, I was going to do things. So I get to this huge college and I didn't know anybody. I didn't have any real friends that were there. And I was extremely alone and extremely isolated and felt so homesick and so depressed. And finally, I met this boy. And just as an aside, most of my stories will start with, well, there was this boy. Okay. Like, a lot of my crap starts with, there was a boy. I found out over the years that who they are actually doesn't matter. It's just sort of interchangeable heads. Because with me, with boys, it's more, it's not that I meet you and I get to know you and I like you. It's more like me, target acquired. You know, like, it just, it's, I pick somebody and you're going to be my hostage. Okay. You're going to be the person that is not free to go. All right. And so I picked this boy, and, you know, he was nice enough to say, hey, we're going to go out tonight and we're going to pregame in my room. I had no idea what pregaming was. No clue. But of course, I don't want you to know I don't know. So I'm like, yeah, pregame. Yeah, that sounds good. Sounds good. What time? So I show up, have no alcohol with me because I don't know anything about it. And he hands me a 750 of something. I think it was vodka. No, Southern Comfort. It was Southern Comfort. And I just did what I saw in the movies, right? I just opened the bottle and I just started chugging, and I mostly finished his bottle. I didn't know any better. And I had a good night. Needless to say, it was a massive party foul, but I think they were more amused at that, because it wasn't long before I was scream singing, I'm Henry VIII, I am, being carried from bar to bar over his shoulder, right? People that I knew from high school, a few of them, we ran into them that night. People are like, Tracy, you know, and nobody could believe that I actually had this part of me that was in there. And I very much relate to the big book talking about when I had alcohol in my system, the first time I got drunk, when I felt the effects of alcohol, not the first time I had it in my system, the first time I felt the effects of it, I came alive. And all of a sudden, you were very, very blessed that I had come to your party. And the truth is, people actually preferred me when I was drinking back then because my sense of humor came out. I was funny. We had a great time. It was really, really good in the beginning. And I shouldn't have been drinking like that. God knows it wasn't healthy. It was way, way, way too much. And I took off like a shot, but it was very difficult for me to recognize it was a problem when I'm living in a fraternity house with nine boys. We called my room the maxi pad. And, I would just do like case races and, all this stuff. Everybody around me was drinking like I drank, right? And nobody got in any trouble and it just seemed fine. But the difference that I didn't notice between me and my peers is they would get up the next day, shake their heads, and go to class. I did not. I would go home and I would sleep through class and go, ah, I was good in high school. It's fine. Because I was used to being able to not really study, not really pay attention, and then cram at the end and ace. That is not, if you go to a good college, don't do that. They don't play. And so I found out that I was failing most of my classes because all like I didn't see it happen, but my entire social experience completely gravitated really rapidly to drinking. And I couldn't have told you that at the time, right? I just thought, I'm having fun. Finally, I'm out of that house. Nobody can tell me what time to go. I started smoking cigarettes. Great idea. And, I just let loose, man. It was like, this is my first time being a human being on planet Earth, right? I'm free. It's great. Well, then the drinking would get bad enough and I would fail a class. And so I would fake, well, it was true. I was depressed, but I would certainly play up the depression and cry and go to the medical students medic center and be like, I just can't go to class and I'm so sad. And they'd be like, oh, okay, well, we're just going to withdraw you from this semester. And my poor parents would have, and like, God, the poor girls that were, lived in the dorm with me were like calling my parents when we think she's going to kill herself. We don't know what's going on. Half the time I was hammered, so I don't even remember what I said half the time. But my poor parents would pack up and come up to the school and take me. Well, another tip in case you're considering it, I did not know that in college, when they withdraw you from a class, it actually impacts your GPA. So my GPA went from a 3.9 in honors classes to like a 0.7. I think I passed college strategies or something. And I'm like, how the hell am I passing this one? Like that's the last thing I have is a college strategy other than drink through it. But it was my GPA sunk. There was nothing going for me. And I did that five or six times, right? I went through my parents being willing to pay for my college. And it was all their fault, right? Like, you just don't understand the childhood you put me through. I have to be like this. You never let me express myself and blah, 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 blah. And finally, my dad had a gut full of it and was like, I am not paying for you anymore. I am done with this. If you want to go, you're going to pay your own way. Well, that is like the perfect, like, little sprinkle of fairy dust on a martyr complex, right? My dad cut me off and now I'm working my way through school. Working my way through school was like showing up for one day at a pizza joint and finding out how bad the money is and be like, I am not doing this. I'm gonna go drink. That like I didn't do it. And that was the worst waitress in the world. Oh my God. I tip really well now because I'm just like convinced that somebody is who I was, and I'm just like, I can't even imagine the poor patrons that had me because I was such a bad waitress. And so, I hemmed and hawed and made my way through college. And me and doctors both got their degrees in 7 years. And I finally got my degree by cheating. That was how I finally got my degree was I was doing online classes and I had a friend who was willing to be my online proctor because he was an accountant. He had graduated like 4 years before. Everybody else has like moved out of college and has like a job and crap. And I'm just sitting there being like, woo, go tech. And everybody else is like, that's not cute anymore, babe. So he was like, I will be your proctor for your online exams. Okay. You just have to come to my house. You just have to sit down and take it. Well, I would take it, but I'd be half hammered or I'd be high. Something would be going on. And he just kind of was like, I can't fail you because if I fail you, you're never going to graduate. So he would just let it push and submitted it. And I have a totally fake degree from Virginia Tech now. And so, you know, if you're cheating to get through life, come sit by me. I totally get it. Has nothing to do with whether I was smart enough. I was plenty smart enough to get a degree. I was plenty smart enough. I wasn't willing to work for it. That's the funny thing about me, is that everything in my life, you know, I never had a consideration that I wouldn't be successful. I never had a thought, right? Like the kids that I went to school with were talking about like, okay, I'm going to go to college and then I'm going to try to do this. And I need to go to study hall to do this. And man, this course is really hard. And then I need to do these courses. And then I need to get an internship so I can get a job. None of that occurred to me. I mean, it was good for you, nice for you, but it never occurred to me that I would have to work to get anything in life. I just expected I would show up, take the exam, it would be easy. And then somebody would just come from, you know, Bill talks about, you know, vast enterprises that they would place me at the head of, right? With absolutely no experience to back it. That was pretty much apparently what I thought was going to happen. And it did not. And I was really poor and really did not have any kind of skills whatsoever, but I finally had a degree and that helped me out. So I move on into young adulthood and I meet the future ex Mrs. Tracy, Mr. Tracy, whatever you want to call it. He was a year sober in AA. And as far as I was concerned, he was Buddha. I had never met a man that wanted to talk about feelings, and I had never met a man that wanted to talk about the spiritual side of life. And I was like, yeah, you know, I just thought it was great. And oh my God, he was completely crazy about me because I'm an alcoholic early in sobriety. So 3 months later, we were engaged and we got married after 11 months, much to my parents' terror. And everyone around me kind of being like, you sure you want to marry this one? I mean, we had nothing in common other than he liked me and I liked me. So, you know, that was good. So, you know, that we got married and that marriage drug on for 4 years. Now, I remember vividly drinking scotch with my best friend, sitting on the dock where near the houses where we were getting married on the beach. And I remember thinking vividly, just tell me I don't have to do this. Just tell me I don't have to do this. And he didn't, because he was a good friend. He hated my husband, but he was a good friend and he kept his mouth shut, right? He respected and honored my wishes. The humility that had to have taken, I still look up to that man as a good friend, because it wasn't his place, right? But I wasn't capable of making a mistake. I could not tell you. Just totally rushed into this just because he's the first person that ever liked me more than just kind of like a one night sort of thing. And I had a habit of that too. Like, ladies, if you're feeling like, you know, you're not good enough for AA, most of my relationships were one night stands that I just didn't leave. Okay. Like I just stayed and, you know, I don't know. It's just the truth. And so this was the first one that actually asked me to come back, you know, so that was very exciting. So, I didn't know I thought that was true love. So we got married and that marriage lasted 4 years. And, finally I got divorced by text message. Because I had brought somebody to the house. We were not happy. Things were not good. He asked me if I wanted a divorce. I said, I think so. And we moved into separate bedrooms and I brought someone over to the house and that person was not friend. They were more than friend. And I just expected him to deal with it, right? Like I had no consideration. Like, I'm mad at you. You deserve this. You made me do this. If you had just acted right. And God bless him. He got in his car and he left and he went to a wedding in his family. And I got a text message the next day from a new number that said, this is my new number. I'm bringing my stuff and I'm filing for divorce. Okay. So I went to the bar, you know, like let's celebrate, right? That was time for shots. So I kept getting worse, right? My drinking just kept getting worse. And I always say that I think that pretty much everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous either falls into, you're either a Bill or you're a Bob, right? Mm-hmm. And it was one of the most disappointing days in my sobriety when I found out that I was a Bill instead of a Bob. right? I wanted so badly to be Bob. I'm like, he's just such a nice guy, you know, like, but Bill's just a jerk, you know. But I found out, like, I would read his story and I'm like, I drank like that, right? That's how I drank. I'm the one that said, you know, oh, you know, the most amazing philosophic thoughts were constructed when people were hammered, right? Everybody around you is going, stop. And you're like, what? Oh no, I got this. It's fine. See, I got a new job. And that was my problem, was that I kept landing on my feet, mostly because my mother kept bankrolling me. She'd feel guilty. I'd tell her some sob story. And so she'd give me money. My father would feel guilty and he'd give me money. And, you know, I kept getting jobs and I'd have them just long enough, instead of, you know, Bill was to pay off the debts at, you know, delis and delicatessens and stuff to pay off his drinking. Mine was just enough to catch up on rent, you know, pay the car notes, so nothing got taken. So on the surface, I looked good. Yep. You wish your 22-year-old was doing as well as I was. Miserable. And so my drinking got worse and worse, and I started drinking. I mean, it really is. I started a women's group a couple of times, and every time I call it Gone Beyond Recall, because that is absolutely my experience, right? I fell off like a ski jump. Like, it was just because when I was finally left alone to drink the way I wanted to drink, it was hideous. I lived in DC and my mom lived in Nelson County. And I remember I did like this drinking tour of all the ABC stores along the way. And I would just get airplane bottles and stuff. I had no recollection of how I got there. And it was my 6-year-old nephew's birthday that he shares with me. So it's my birthday. He got birthday cake. I spent the entire evening vomiting in the toilet. And my mom was like, are you okay? I'm like, just a flu, you know, and everybody bought it, right? Because, well, she's got a job. She's doing fine. I mean, she seems like, you know, it's off, but like, she must be okay. So I finally called that ex-husband, right? That had been in AA. And I used to drunk dial with him all the time because, hey, the devil, you know, right? And so, and it wasn't like I was just exuding reasons to be attractive to people at the bar, right? Even the guys at the bar were like, whoa. You know, like, so it's not good when you're in that spot. And y'all were the guys at the bar. So I know, you know how bad that had to be. You know, and so I called him and he had been, you know, like I said, he was a year sober when we met. And when we were together, he stopped going to AA. And I didn't know anything about that. I didn't know it was bad. I didn't know anything at all about it. And he kind of started drinking again and like things got bad. But he was like, I'm not an alcoholic at that point, right? When I had called him, he was like, I'm not an alcoholic, but I think they can help you. And I credit that man, if for nothing else, for saving my life. Because at that point in time, I wasn't listening to the judge. I wasn't listening to my parents. I wasn't listening to my friends. My friends, the remonstrances of my friends terminated in a row, you know, and I was a lone wolf, right? Bill, again. I had nobody. I had nothing left. And he was the only one that would still pick up. And he was like, I think you need to go to AA. And so in 2009, I started darkening your doors. Okay. And when I mean darken, I mean the newcomer that comes in drunk, crying, and a total pain in the butt that you pray doesn't sit next to you. That's me. The one that like gets mad and throws chairs and like you have to call the cops. That was me. I would go to meetings hammered because there was no other way. There's no way that I was going to come sober to this meeting because I didn't have the courage. At that point, I couldn't even go grocery shopping. I was young. I was 28 years old at the time, and I did not have a high bottom, even that young. I was yellow. I could not, you know, my liver was not keeping up with the amount of alcohol I was consuming. I had lost absolutely everything. I had lost the dog. I had lost the house. I had lost the husband. I had lost my business. I had lost my family. For the most part, were like at a point of nothing to do with me. All of my friends were gone. Like, there was nothing left for me. And it was Thanksgiving Day, the day before Thanksgiving, and in 2009. And my boss had left and left me to watch the shop. And she went home to her family. And there was an ABC store directly across like the little mini mall, right? And I remember like being like, Maybe just an airplane. And of course, it built and built and built. And I went back over there three or four times, right? Because I'm one of the lucky ones that, you know, I define alcoholism the way that the big book does. When you take a drink, you find that you cannot stop. Or when you honestly want to, you cannot stay stopped. I'm one of the lucky ones that it's and. If you put it in my system, all bets are off. All right. And when I'm off of it, there's no chance I'm staying stopped. At some point, I will pick up again, whether it's for a good reason, a bad reason, no reason at all, a random Tuesday, a day that ends in Y. I'm going to end up drinking at some point, right? It's just not going to happen. So I ended up ramming my car into the back of some poor girl when I was headed home. I was absolutely hammered, and I was supposed to go meet a girlfriend at the bar, and got into a wreck, got a DUI, and got thrown in jail. And this does not look good in jail. This doesn't go to jail, especially not Fairfax. That was not a good look. And I was so hammered, I was blaming everything on my arresting officer. So like I'm amazed I didn't get an assault charge. Like I tried to, they put two cops on me because I was so ornery. And they put one on each arm, and I was itty bitty back then. And I thought, you idiots, you just gave me leverage. So like I lifted up and like tried to kick him in the jaw and only missed him by like that much. I have no idea how I did not end up with more charges, other than he was a very patient man, and maybe more of that fairy dust got sprinkled. But God was like, nope, I'm gonna need you. You know, who knows? But actually, I doubt that. I don't really believe that God gives some people out of trouble and others not. But I just got lucky, and I didn't go to jail. I dressed myself up. I started going to meetings because, you know, that's what you do to get out of trouble, right? You go and you show the judge all your little things. Well, the problem was that I started collecting 24-hour chips into a piggy bank because I couldn't stop. And I didn't know I couldn't stop, right? I didn't know that because I'd never tried. I didn't give a crap about stopping. Why should I stop? You're my problem, right? So I tried to stop and I couldn't. It was chip after chip after chip. And I remember I would go to the meeting and I was so like, do you know those new people that like it's like they're on amphetamines, but they're actually not because they're just so wired? That was me. It was just, and I would sit there and I would have the where and when. And the only way I could sit in the meeting and listen is I would color in like the spaces, like a 6-year-old does, right? Like in the words, you know, like the letters would have like an A has a little circle and I would color that in. And I would like do a chalk mark for my days sober. And I'd scratch it off and I'd have to start again. I'd scratch it off. I still have that. I still have that book. I still have that piggy bank, which is almost full because I wasn't willing. I came here and I wanted you to fix me. Just tell me what to do. I mean, I'm not ignorant. Like I can read, you know, like it's not complicated. And you poor people, like some of you had like GEDs and stuff. And like, I'm so sorry for you. Like, you clearly need to stop drinking because you need to do something with your life. Meanwhile, they owned a home and had a happy marriage and, you know, all that crap. But, you know, no, me, the homeless girl, I was definitely giving great advice. And so I didn't have a sponsor. Like, I am the best sponsor in, or the best like speaker in the world if you are trying to find out all the ways AA doesn't work. Okay. It does not work, at least for me, if you have a sponsor, but they don't know you're their sponsor or that they're your sponsor. It does not work if you have a sponsor and you do not go through the steps. It does not work if you go through the steps, but by yourself. It does not work if you go through the steps, you talk to a sponsor, but you don't go to meetings. It doesn't work if you go to meetings and you don't have service positions and you only occasionally see your sponsor and you refuse to help anybody else because I need more help. That doesn't work either. It doesn't work if you sponsor people without going through the steps. Like every single possible way that was not in the black part in the book, I tried. And every single one of them got me another chip into that piggy bank, right? And eventually, I got on the right track. I got a sponsor. I started doing all three of the things, right? I started having a sponsor. She knew she was my sponsor. We were working the steps. And then the other actions of going to meetings, having service positions, helping other people. Like, if you have a day, you can bring somebody to the meeting as long as you're sober enough to do it. You know, like it's, you can do something. You know what I mean? Like, or if you have 10 days, the person with one day might be more comfortable with you. Nobody was comfortable with me. I was Yeah, Junji talks about, like, if you want to know how to go to an AA meeting and have a row all to yourself, come talk to me. I have that same experience. You know, people talk about, oh my God, the women just swept me up. I told them I would cut them. All right. So like, there was no swooping me up in the fellowship, and it was my fault. You know, it's like, you know, I need your help. I need your help. Don't touch me. And that took years. It's still, vulnerability is still not my favorite thing. Okay. The women that I sponsor know at times when I've got stuff going on, I can be a bit of a prickly pear, but it's so much better than it was. All right. It's so much better than it was. And when I started doing stuff with that sponsor, when I started going through the steps, when I started actually doing stuff, unfortunately, my reptile brain came back and it was, oh, this is just the look at me, look what I can do show. I can do this. This is easy. I can make all the coffee and I can make sure I always look cute and I could put all the lipstick on that pig. And there was nothing behind it, right? There was no surrender behind it. I knew that I was powerless over alcohol and my life was unmanageable. I knew it would take some kind of miracle, but I was not willing to turn my will and my life over to something that was invisible, right? There was no way, because with my childhood, I had prayed to that God. I didn't not believe in God. I hated his guts because I had prayed to that God to make those things stop, and they didn't stop. So people would tell me, you need to pray more, and I would spit on the ground at their feet. That is the charmer that you got in 2009 through 2011. My apologies. And I just couldn't do it. I wouldn't do it. And then things just kept getting worse, and I got pneumonia. And I was really sick, and I had all the service positions. I was sponsoring people. I was doing all the things you're supposed to do, but I had not surrendered. And they put me on morphine because my pneumonia turned into pleurisy. And me and morphine had a nice little party. And I never overtook it. I never took anything that I wasn't supposed to. I went off of it. And then without telling my sponsor, went back on it. And the reason I took more of it was because I was supposed to lead a meeting that night and I was afraid. That's not sober behavior for this alcohol, right? That's not. But what happened was I felt it wake up inside of me for the first time. I had never had the experience of being sober long enough to feel it wake up. And if you know what it is, you should probably stay. Because my mother, when I told her that, she has no idea what I'm talking about. Okay. There is no it. There's just, what, were you like out of business or something? Like, it's just, there's nothing. Right. And for me, I felt it wake up and it scared the crap out of me because I knew I had to have something bigger than my little Barbie show of, you know, trying to look with the cool kids. Man, I was 30 years old trying to hang out with the cool kids club that were like 22. Okay. I mean, that in itself should have been a red flag. You know, now I'm like, I'm too old, honey. But you know, I wasn't still surrendered. I wasn't okay being me. And when that happened, I chose to pick up a white chip. Now my husband still disagrees. He says, you didn't overtake it, blah, blah. You should have, you know, 15 months more than you do. I'm good. Cause I sleep just fine. Because I knew for me, that was when I surrendered. I knew my sponsor could say I am her least favorite sponsee. The home group could burn to the ground. All my friends could be like, yeah, we hate your guts just as much as people did when you were drinking. And I still couldn't drink. I knew I was going to die if I kept this up. I knew it. I felt it in my bones. And that's when it changed. And I took on to this like, only the dying can, right? It was a life preserver. And I did every single thing you told me to do, but I did it from here. I did it in sweatpants and dirty t-shirts because I would come in and I'm like, I'm having a bad day, you know, but like I would do the coffee, you know, like I would do whatever I needed to do because I was here, pardon me, to save my ass and not my face. You know what I mean? It finally changed. And what I have had as an experience in sobriety. If you're new, whatever it is that you think you want out of Alcoholics Anonymous, I pray that you stay longer than you think you should. Because you will sell yourself so short. The experience, like if I could give you, there's some speaker that I heard years ago, and I love this. She said, if I could give you what I have today, what I've learned, the person I've become, I wouldn't, because I wouldn't rob you of the journey. And I know that sounds like super ethereal and touchy-feely, which is not really me, but it's true. And it's annoyingly true. Because the only way for me to find a God of my understanding that can solve my problems, note in the book, it does not say solve your drinking problem. It says setting aside the drinking problem we were making heavy going of life, right? I just sucked at living, right? Like being sober was my problem. Alcohol was my solution. It's what made it bearable to get through another day. You want me to be one of those soccer moms out there that just like goes and like has PTA crap and has like a helium machine in her house because she blows up balloons for parties and crap? No, ma'am. No, ma'am. There's an Al-Anon speaker that I love to death. Her name's Mary Pearl T, and I'm sure some of you know who she is. And she talks about how, you know, I told my sponsor, she's a million years old and she lives in Texas. If you see this, I love you. You're not really a million. But she's been speaking for 50 years. And she was like, I came in, I saw this woman and I looked at my sponsor and I said, you better not make me a cookie baking woman. And my sponsor said, don't worry, honey, you'll be a cookie baking witch. And that's the women that I sponsor, right? Like that's my sponsorship family, is we are cookie making witches, right? We're sarcastic. We're funny. We are the absolute, the people that everybody else is terrified. Come sit by us. It's fine. I'm not worried you're going to cut me. You know, like it's fine. If you're still drunk at a meeting, come sit by me. I got you. If you get disruptive, I'm big enough. You'll come outside. You know, like it's fine. And the God that I started to have revealed to me. They always say, don't quit before the miracle happens. A lot of people think the miracle is that you stop drinking. That's not my miracle. It's a miracle that I did. Don't get me wrong. That's a miracle. But it's not the miracle. The miracle was I had been sober for 7, 8 years, and I still struggled with a God that I could trust. Don't ever let anybody tell you you need a bigger God. You just need to trust the God you have. It's not usually that you don't think your God is big enough. It's usually that you don't trust that God is gonna. Why does it say in the steps, God could and would if he were sought? First of all, you got to seek him, right? And could and would. It's not can't. It's just that he would, right? And so I still struggled with that. And I was working this job. Oh, God, I hated this job. My sponsor, its sponsor validated that they were the worst humans imaginable. And she even still jokes about it. She's like, at least you're not working for Boyd anymore. You know, it's, they were horrible people. And they had serious alcoholism rampant through the company. And it was extremely difficult. And I had a husband who's 100% disabled with a 9-month-old baby. And they put me on travel 40%. My family was completely dependent on me for income. Justin was trying to go to college. So he was trying to go to college with a 9-month-old with his wife gone 40% of the time. And I'm dealing with this bunch of drunken idiots constantly, right? It was with the trucking industry. Truckers drink like truckers, just FYI. All right. And so like it fits. So I get to go on all these different trips. My whole life, I wanted to see Alaska. My whole life. I am a big Antarctic nerd. Okay. Like if there is a David Attenborough documentary on something cold, I promise you I've seen it and I could probably narrate it for you. Okay. My husband thinks it's hysterical. And I got a chance to go and nobody else in my company was going. It was just me for once. And I got to fly up there first class. And I see out the window of the plane, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles of ice and snow and mountains. And I kid you not, I went like my little kid just lit up, right? So I go and I do my business. I do my work, the things I'm supposed to do while I'm there. And for most of the time, I was so depressed when I would go on these trips because my husband wasn't with me and I missed my family. I highly recommend getting married in sobriety to somebody who's also sober because you grow up together. And it is the most beautiful thing. I adore my husband. He's my best friend in the world. And we're good parents to our kids. Like the Commonwealth actually lets me keep my kids. It's amazing. And, you know, so I always was sad and I wouldn't do anything. well, this trip, I had wanted it so much that I said, I'm going to leave the room. Like I felt this nudge to like get out of the hotel. So I went and I did, you know, walked up the rivers and like went to this thing to go see moose and all this stuff, right? Like I was a good grand old little Anchorage tourist. Well, the last day, the thing I really wanted to see was this huge glacier that's on the edge of a lake, right? And I was right at the beginning of spring. And so and the lake freezes, right? And so the way to get to the glacier is you walk on the frozen lake and it's like 7 miles, right? So I go out there and there's like nobody out there. And I'm going, oh my God, I'm going to die. This is how it ends. You know, I'm going to be sober, but I'm going to drown, you know, like, I don't know what to do. Well, I see this guy up there. He's a, you know, park ranger or whatever. And I'm like, do I want to do this? He's like, looks with his little binoculars, goes, oh, there's still locals playing. You're fine. If there's no locals, you're going to die. If there's, you know, because they don't monitor it, they leave it alone. And so he said, there's locals, so go do it. Well, there was like three people. It really wasn't that many. So I'm walking on this ice and it's slow going. Okay. It's slow going walking on solid ice. And you hear creak beneath you. You know, you hear creak, pop. You see little air bubbles and you're going, shit. You know, like, did I make a wise decision? And it was 7 miles. But there was nobody anywhere near me. And I come around this curve and I see a glacier for the first time in my life. And it's so huge. It's so big. And it's so beautiful. And I swear to you, I relate to Bill when he talks about God for him, talks to him like a great neon sign or like a great thought that crowded out all us, right? For me, it's like a neon sign. And I know it's God because it talks in a language I don't use, right? Like, I don't know how to explain it. It's not how I talk, right? And I hear this thought, this is for you just because I wanted you to have it. And I kid you not, I swear to God, it giggled. And that, my sponsor still refers to it as Alaska God, changed everything about my sobriety. What the miracle was for me was when God became personal to Tracy. I could look at each and every one of you and I knew God was working in your life. I could look at everybody I sponsored and you'd be like, oh my God, I lost my job. Everything's terrible. I didn't even stop eating my chicken. I'm like, where am I fine? You know, like it's fine. Go find a newcomer and take a meeting, you know? And, you know, they would curse me under their breath, but they'd do it and it would always work out fine, right? And that particular God has stayed with me through some of the most amazing, some of the most difficult, some of the most painful experiences. Because just because you get sober, it doesn't mean that life's not lifey, okay? After our first child, right, he was a surprise, a very happy surprise, because I have some complications and we didn't think we could, right? So he just, pop, and there he was, right? Well, then we had three miscarriages back to back. And when that came around, I was like, I have one more in me. I have one more try in me and I can't do this anymore. It breaks my heart every time. Well, then we got pregnant with our youngest and we had a simple surgery and like 5 seconds later, I was pregnant and Max came into the world and he was beautiful and he was perfect. Well, at 5 months old, my baby started having something called infantile spasms. Mm. And it turned out that he has extensive abnormalities of his brain. They control communication, they control eating, they control chewing. He has these seizures that they're not like regular epileptic seizures. They're catastrophic. He also has cerebral palsy because of the brain abnormalities. And he has a genetic disorder that there are only 500 people in the world that have that particular protein off. Max, of course, my child, is the only one in medical history who has his specific misspelling. So I gave birth to a unicorn. I think my higher power thought that was funny, you know? But the thing is, I wasn't alone. I'm not the type to be like, hey, come help me. Like, I'm not that person. Okay. Unless I'm moving, it's, you know, but you guys came out of the woodwork. He was on, he needed a medication that there was only one company in the world that made it. And it was $200,000 per treatment and the insurance didn't cover it. You guys came out of the woodwork. People showed up making deposits into the GoFundMe. I'm a nonprofit person. So professionally I fundraise. So I was like, okay, I'm just going to get into gear. Like I got to do what I got to do for my child. Right. So I didn't sleep, I didn't eat, I just did the deal, right? And all of a sudden, this GoFundMe starts having like $1,000 deposits, $3,000 deposits, $5,000 deposits. And it's from people from our old home group that we moved away from 6 years earlier. People that I haven't spoken to in years. Word got out at our old home group and people just went nuts. And they started sending us. And he was in the hospital in, it was right before Thanksgiving when it started. And he was in the hospital at around Christmas time. And a friend of mine who has a special needs son called me and said, "Oh, did you get Eli, our older son, Christmas presents?" And I went, "Oh my God." Like, we had totally forgotten, because at that point we didn't know if Max was going to live or die. And it was during COVID. So I couldn't, my husband couldn't come to the hospital. I couldn't leave. Like, we were stuck. And they went and found my son's Amazon wish list and bought all of it. Like, not like, you know, like 20 presents or something, like that'll really explode. No, no, no. This was like 180 presents that he had been putting on there because my kid's a nut job. And, you know, I don't know where he gets it. And like, I mean, the Amazon guy was like, "What did you do?" You know, it just kept coming. We had to put it in a separate room and lock it because it was floor to ceiling boxes. That was on top of helping my child get his medication. The God that I have today, there's nothing that God can't do. I went from being the person that spits on the ground at your feet to the person who says, "If you don't have it, you don't need it yet. And when you need it, I promise you, you will have it." It can look a million different ways. I can't tell you how many times I would have a bill and I'm like, "I don't know how I'm going to pay this bill. It's crazy." My sponsor would be like, "Just keep doing AA, do the thing." And then I'd get a letter in the mail, be like, "Wells Fargo, oh, we overcharged you for your car note 8 years ago. Here's something within $3 of what you need for this bill." Mm-hmm. It's happened to me like 20 times. I believe in a God that absolutely has you. And if you do not believe that you can come as you are, if somebody like me has a God that's personal to them, don't quit before the miracle happens, guys. I love you very much, and thank you for my life.